Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man I've come to regard with the greatest of, admiration as well as personal affection for his leadership in that war, both in the kinetic phases of it, frankly, as well as the phases that are now taking place in Capitol Hill. He is Congressman Mike Pompeo. He is a member of the House Intelligence Committee, a member of the House Select Committee on Benghazi, also the Committee on Energy and Commerce. But in a previous life, he was first in the class graduate of West Point, a man who went on to be a member of the United States Army, an officer there for some 6 years, including a combat tour. He was also a member of the Harvard Law School graduating program, a man of many parts, in short, and always a welcome guest here. Congressman Mike Pompeo, welcome back. Good to have you with us, sir.
Frank, it's great to be with you. I didn't have a combat tour, but there were days it felt like it.
I'm sure. Let me talk to you about combat at the moment, sir. Leadership fight in the House of Representatives. Any insights on how that's likely to sort?
Well, yes, sir. We as a caucus are looking for a conservative leader to take the House forward. Today, I think where it sits is there have been about a half dozen folks that have expressed some interest, including me. And we're trying to find the right place. We're trying to figure it out. If Congressman Paul Ryan is full-throated and wants to do it, I believe he is a man with deep conservative instincts. I know there are others who have attacked him. I've gotten to know Paul. He started out in the Kansas delegation as a staff person. I know Paul by heart, and his heart is for freedom and liberty, and his work on crushing the entitlements that are crushing the people of Kansas and all across America has been noble and unequaled. And so I'm hopeful that he will move forward and we can rally to him. I mean, we, America, can rally to him. I think that'd be a great turn for our country.
We'll be watching it closely, as will, of course, you. And I'm very intrigued to hear that you might be a candidate yourself. Going to be doubly interested, of course, in the outcome as a result. Congressman, a couple of other things that I'd like to just touch on quickly with you. There is a rising level of violence against Israel at the moment. Some of it has been described as kind of a third intifada, but there certainly seems to be a growing appetite on the part of Israel's other enemies to go at it with her. Do you think it's likely that at least part of why this is happening is a sense that the United States is no longer standing behind Israel as it has in the past at the UN and elsewhere, for that matter, under President Obama?
Frank, I think it is almost certain that that's the case. Whether you are a member of Hamas in the Gaza Strip or a Palestinian in the West Bank, you watch a president of the United States who has consistently sided with the side that was opposing Israel for his entire time in office, and you realize you have but a year and a half left to make as much progress as you can, and know that when you do that, you'll be met with relatively little resistance. And so I think it is, it's the case that you now have Russian aircraft flying within about 2 minutes of the Israeli borders, and that is a fundamental geostrategic shift. And I think everyone watches that. I know the Israelis are watching it closely, but I think those that want to destroy Israel watching it equally closely and know that they have a window of opportunity.
Yeah, that's a chilling thought, and I'm afraid you're absolutely right. Congressman, tonight Hillary Clinton will be presumably inveighing against the select committee on which you serve concerning Benghazi, deriding it, frankly, unfortunately, partly by reference to your majority leader, Kevin McCarthy, that this is just a political witch hunt. You've been serving on that committee for some time. You've taken exception to this kind of characterization. Give us the flavor of what your response to Hillary would be.
Frank, I always, when I'm involved in something, just speak about the facts as I know them. I've watched this committee operate now since May of 2014. I've watched this attempt to get a hold of documents and watched Secretary Clinton and the State Department behave in the most obstructionist way. I've watched our Democrat colleagues on the committee do the same. They haven't lifted one finger to get a single fact about the death of four Americans on their watch, too. And I've watched this committee behave in a way that is incredibly professional and aimed at getting answers. We've conducted dozens and dozens of depositions and interviews. We've looked at tens of thousands of documents. Secretary Clinton has been a very small part of that, but she was the senior U.S. diplomat when one of her ambassadors was killed. It would be investigatory malpractice if we didn't conduct a hearing with her, and we'll do it a week from now.
Yeah. You will be talking with her on that occasion, the hearing with Hillary Clinton, much anticipated, long awaited, among other things, about her conduct of email insecurity, I guess is one way of putting it, with respect to, among other things, to the Benghazi matter. There have been, again, claims that this is all much ado about nothing. Your quick assessment of her, well, culpability for misconduct in that regard.
You know, I think it's pretty apparent when the Secretary of State is telling nearly every employee of the State Department, we have to have you conducting official business on official government equipment and communications lines, but she creates an exception for herself. I think that tells you the answer about the risk that was created when someone doesn't follow the procedures that have been put in place, not only for the good of the Secretary of State, but for the safety of all the people that work for and around her.
Does it trouble you, Congressman Mike Pompeo of Kansas, that the President of the United States, in the midst of an investigation by his Justice Department and the FBI, has said that he doesn't think there was any problem in terms of national security?
That was both weird and unsurprising, if you can hold those two thoughts in your head at the same time, Frank. There's a significant investigation being undertaken by Director Comey of the FBI. And they need to do their work and get to a conclusion and then share that conclusion with the American people, whatever it might be. Very odd to see the President of the United States predetermine the outcome of that investigation.
Well, one hopes it doesn't contaminate the pursuit of the facts, either by the executive branch or by, of course, yourself and the others in the Congress. Two other quick issues, if we can, Congressman, and we're going to do a lightning round here. You have come up on the net rather vigorously, as has one of your Senate colleagues, Senator Pat Roberts, and the governor of your state of Kansas, Governor Sam Brownback, against the idea of President Obama depositing at Fort Leavenworth detainees from Guantanamo Bay. Why is that a problem?
Well, Frank, I don't want them anywhere but the place that they are, for starters.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be held in that exact place.
As you say, not in anybody's backyard, not just yours.
Yeah, right. Not in anybody's backyard. They need to be held there because it's an enormously important intelligence collection asset for us to have the ability to bring unlawful enemy combatants to a location where we can conduct interrogations to take down Al-Qaeda and ISIS and all the network of jihadists around them. And so I don't want them anywhere. Putting them in the States, whether it's Fort Leavenworth or any place else, presents enormous risk to a nation and a feeding frenzy for liberal plaintiffs lawyers who will do everything they can to make sure those folks never come to trial.
Yeah, and perhaps jihadists as well. Lastly, and we only have a minute or so left, Congressman Mike Pompeo, you have been at the forefront of the effort to defeat what I call the Obama bomb deal. Does the recent test of a long-range missile with apparently maneuvering warhead capability, clearly a nuclear delivery system, by the Iranians in the midst of all of this business of providing them, among other things, $150 billion in windfall funds, causes a new basis for opposing this agreement?
It most certainly does. It is precisely what one might expect from a deal of this nature. It's amazing. The Obama administration has already conceded it violates the UN resolution. They've not yet conceded that it violates the agreement itself. My sense is that it does. I need to see the technical activity that took place. I've not seen that formally. But put the legal aside for just a moment. It certainly is telling about the Iranians' intent to continue to develop a nuclear arsenal. And I suspect we will see more of that. The president says sanctions will snap back. I think it's time.
Yeah, well, I'm not holding my breath, and I know you're not either, but I'm hoping that you will redouble your efforts, Congressman, with everything else on your plate to scupper this deal. You've done a very, very heroic job so far, and we need to get it put over the top, finally. Congressman Mike Pompeo, again, thank you very much for your visits with us periodically. We appreciate them enormously, as we do your leadership in the United States Congress on the Energy Committee and the Intelligence Committee, and, of course, not least, in the Select Committee on Benghazi. We look forward to perhaps talking with you after Hillary Clinton's appearance next week. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us soon. Louise Fleischman joins us on Colombia and the FARC. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for a minute for Frank Gaffney, who will be back later in the program. I have the pleasure of speaking with Louise Fleischman. And Luis is the senior advisor to our own Mengus Hemispheric Security Project, as well as an adjunct professor at Florida Atlantic University. And Luis, I wanted to check in with you. We talk an awful lot on this show and elsewhere about all of the terrorist threats and other issues that threaten our security. But right here, just a hair south, we've got a very evil group in FARC, and they've been actually reined in a bit, but seem to have made a deal with the Colombian government that may not be all that it was cracked up to be. Can you fill us in a little bit on that?
The government of Colombia and the FARC agreed on, a few weeks ago, on the issue of some sort of a peace agreement. The final peace agreement is supposed to be signed in March. However, at this point, they agreed in principle to a few things, such as agrarian reform, the political participation of the FARC, the elimination of armed conflict, and then they agreed also to eradicate and substitute illegal crops, namely the crop of the coca crop, and to fight against drug trafficking. Now, all this sounds very good, but I think in reality it's by far more complex. I think the FARC, operates, is not only a guerrilla movement, but it's also a drug cartel. As a drug cartel, they operate along with many, many criminal organizations.
We're talking with Luis Fleischman, who is part of the Mengus Hemispheric Security Project that we run here at the Center for Security Policy. And he was telling us how the deal that the Colombian government has made with FARC may run into problems due to the fact that FARC runs a criminal enterprise. They're part of a drug cartel, and they work with a lot of the other criminal elements in the drug trafficking business. Luis, you were basically saying that fact alone may be enough to derail this.
Absolutely. The problem is that maybe the FARC will be smart enough to reach an agreement with Colombia, but at the same time to continue these criminal activities, let's say, since they have the know-how of the illegal business, maybe they can work with Venezuela and with the coca growers in Peru and Ecuador, and then carry out a different criminal activities, this time outside Colombia. So they have an agreement with Colombia, so they don't have the Colombian army going after them. But they continue their criminal activities in the region. That's a possibility, and this continues to be a major challenge for the United States, even though the United States has supported the peace process with the FARC. So that's one of the major problems. The other problem is the problem of transitional justice. You know, the agreement that was reached between the FARC and Colombia basically talks about trying the criminals. But on the other hand, there is an element of amnesty depending on what kind of criminal act has been committed, and also to what extent, the person that committed those crimes actually gives himself or herself up or not. You know, there are a number of conditions.
So as it turns out, they may end up just letting some of the worst offenders go because of the power that they have and the influence that they have, and then, you know, maybe throw some of the lesser fish under the bus and prosecute them to make it look like they're abiding by the rules of the treaty.
Oh, absolutely. And now, for instance, according to the agreement, serious crimes are not going to get any amnesty. And now the FARC is claiming that for certain instances of kidnapping, there could be amnesty. And so at this point, there are differences between the interpretation that the government gives to the agreement and the interpretation that the FARC gives to the agreements. And what is interesting even more is that the entire details of the agreements have not been made available to the public. So that means that even the public cannot touch. And the question is why these agreements have not been available to the public. And I believe it's because probably Santos, the government of Colombia, knows that once these agreements are being made public, there is going to be a serious debate, and support for the agreements is going to deteriorate. That would be my guess.
Well, that seems to sound familiar to me, because that is exactly what happened with President Obama and the Iran deal. You can negotiate in private and make all of these agreements, but when they see the light of day, the public isn't that happy. But let's talk about another neighboring country. There's elections coming up in Venezuela, and there seems to have been an awful lot of government maneuvering to take the opposition out of play, including imprisoning its leader. Give us an update on the current state of play in elections in Venezuela.
Well, first of all, interesting, because the government of Venezuela is well aware that if they go for clean elections, which, by the way, will take place on December 6th, the parliamentary elections, they are likely to lose, because the economic situation is horrible in Venezuela. The citizen security is terrible. There is a situation of basically insecurity, scarcity of basic products in Venezuela, an economic situation that is going down the hill, increasing authoritarianism. And so the only way that the Venezuelan government has to keep itself in power, remember, the government of Venezuela is a revolutionary government, so their aim is to maintain themselves in power. In other words, they are not, by definition, they are not supposed to give up power. But the question is that they have to regain it via elections. They have to say the people want us in power. And they know they will not be able to do it. And so, and this election is going to be a reflection of that. Therefore, they are going to appeal to two elements. One is imprisonment of political leaders that can threaten the government of Maduro, which they have been doing it. Dismissal, in other words, declaring candidates not qualified to be candidates for reasons that they make up, like, for instance, criminal charges or charges of corruption or, you know, whatever. And third, which is, this is what most probably is going to take place, is also fraud, cybernetic fraud in the elections. This is going to be discussed, by the way, at the program that we are having in Capitol Hill on October 29th, by the way, co-sponsored by the Center for Security Policy. Adriana Vigilanza, who is an expert on these issues, is going to talk about the upcoming elections, I mean, the evidence with regard to fraud in Venezuela. So, and this is what is going on. Leopoldo López, who is a major leader that did absolutely no wrong, has been put in prison for 14 years, I'm sorry, and under dubious charges. You know, the Electoral Commission that is supposed to oversee a decent process and legitimate electoral process is absolutely on the side of Maduro. So nothing is really legal. Nothing is really legitimate of what is going on in Venezuela. Venezuela is not a decent country. In fact, it's a rogue country. It's a drug trafficking country. And it's a country also associated with terrorism. And I think the White House has not yet understood this.
Well, hopefully the conference you mentioned on Capitol Hill will offer an opportunity to both inform and influence U.S. policy in that direction. Folks, we've been talking with Luis Fleischman, who is the senior advisor to the Menges Hemispheric Security Project, which is a program run by the Center for Security Policy. Luis, great pleasure. And up next, Frank will be back talking with Andy McCarthy. This is Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The evidence continues to mount that President Obama's deal with Iran is the worst national security agreement in our country's history. The latest indicator of that dubious distinction came with recent Iranian tests of long-range ballistic missiles.
The missiles are designed to carry nuclear warheads, first to Europe and, with further improvements, to the United States. Those warheads will reportedly be able to maneuver, a capability we currently, scandalously, have no defenses to defeat. U.S. officials are excusing these ominous missile tests by claiming that they do not violate the Obama bomb deal. They're blithely assuring our allies we'll protect them against such threats. These assertions compound the falsehoods deployed previously to sell this grievously defective accord. Its supporters, especially Democratic presidential candidates debating tonight in Las Vegas, must be held accountable for national security fraud, and the Obama bomb deal must be repudiated. This is Frank Gaffney.
They are fathers and mothers, someone's best friend, and America's true heroes. Whether out on the front lines or here on the home front, our troops are sacrificing every day, making sure that we continue to have the freedoms that make this country great.
Hi, I'm Congressman Chris Stewart. As a former Air Force pilot, I understand that our troops and their families continue to give so much for our country. Let them know you appreciate their service. A simple thank you can go a long way.
Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here.
Do this better than any station in town.
Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. Last week, the Obama bomb, Iran nuclear deal survived votes in the House and Senate with zero Republican support. The Obama administration and their supporters are trying to discount a powerful Republican criticism of this deal that there are secret side deals allowing Iran to inspect itself for nuclear activities. Critics claim the failure to provide these deals to Congress means the clock for congressional review never started and Obama cannot lift sanctions against Iran. Obama officials claim the side deals argument is a distraction, that these deals are not part of the nuclear agreement, and that they are part of a normal and private arrangement between the IAEA and Iran. The side deals are not a normal arrangement, and there are strong indications they were written by the Obama administration and hidden in secret side deals to conceal them from Congress. The side deals are not a distraction. They constitute national security fraud. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. The high point of our week has arrived. It is our visit with Andy McCarthy, the former federal prosecutor turned pundit extraordinaire. You find his extraordinary, and I mean extraordinary, writings at places like National Review Online and PJ Media. You can also, I hope, find them on your Amazon site or at your local bookstore, where they are leading the New York Times bestsellers with great regularity, including his most recent book, Faithless Execution, the case for the impeachment of Barack Obama. Let me ask you, Andy McCarthy, about a piece that you wrote this past week, which I think was extraordinarily important in terms of both your analysis and the necessity for that analysis, namely your assessment of the Syria debacle. Give us a flavor of what your take is on what's wrong with what we've been doing there so far and what we ought to do going forward.
Well, Frank, my take on Syria, which I don't know if I should regret this or not, but has been pretty different from the take of most of the people I'm often aligned with from the start, has been that we just have a total misunderstanding of what Syria is in terms of its population and the different parties to the conflict. And I don't think we're ever going to get to the right strategy and the hard choices that have to be made until we have a clear-eyed assessment of what we're dealing with there. And the main thing, to be more concrete about it, is there's kind of this Washington fantasy that Syria is actually teeming with these secular moderates, and that if only somebody had helped them at the critical moment, the whole situation could have been different. But because there was indifference to their plight and there wasn't enough aid and arms given to them, a void was created that the Beltway usually calls the vacuum, into which bad actors like ISIS and now Putin have jumped in. And I just think that's an absurd depiction of Syria. And I've noted from the beginning that when people in Washington talk about the rebels, they're very careful to say the rebels or the moderate Islamists. And that's because they don't want to tell people that the backbone of the opposition to Assad in Syria has always, always been the Muslim Brotherhood. And while they may be more moderate than, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, that's kind of like saying a dictator is more moderate than Hitler. You know, it just doesn't, I'm not a big fan of Hitler comparisons, but in this case, I think it's actually apt. The Muslim Brotherhood's not our friend. And it's no surprise to me that in Syria, as in Libya, when aid was given to these Islamists, it ended up, by and large, in the hands of radical jihadists, because these are people who work together seamlessly. And unless we get that right about Syria, I don't think that we're going to understand the strategic situation. I don't think we understand the enemy that we're facing there. And I just don't think we're ever going to get it right.
Not our friend seems to me to be an understatement of epic proportions with respect to the Brotherhood.
Well,
as you know better than anybody.
If I'm going to mention Hitler, I could do understatement too.
And Lenny, let me ask you about this latest development. The administration says that they're not going to fool around with trying to find moderates who will use our weapons only against the Islamic State and not against the regime, this being now replaced with a policy of arming anybody out there in the field, maybe not anybody, but it sounds as though, especially as you say, based on hard experience, that whoever we wind up arming in the field is going to either voluntarily or involuntarily have those arms turned over in due course to Al-Qaeda, maybe, or perhaps also, and or, as they say, to the Islamic State. Can you explain what the latest logic is? Is it other than that the past policy has just proven completely bankrupt and this is likely to do the same?
Yeah, I think it's illogic, Frank, because, you know, before we were looking around for moderates to give weapons to fight ISIS, we were looking for moderates to give weapons to fight Assad. And that's part of how we ended up with ISIS. And I'm not saying that we're wholly responsible for that development, but I think, you know, we ought to recognize who ISIS is, right? ISIS is Al-Qaeda, that's all. There's an internal spat in Al-Qaeda, but ISIS began as Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And look, when we get involved in this, and it's been botched enough that eventually we'll have to, because the one thing that we know about violent jihadists is that when they have safe haven, they attack the United States in our interest. So they now have more safe haven than they've ever had in what used to be Iraq and Syria. I think those borders will probably never be the same again. But eventually, we're going to have to take care of this because, and this has been true also from day one, Frank, if the strategic national security problem for the United States is that when terrorists have safe haven, they attack the United States, then that's not a problem you can responsibly delegate to the quote-unquote rebels of some other country. That's our problem. So, you know, this whole idea that, you know, we're going to delegate our national security to these haphazardly thrown together quote-unquote secular moderates who have a lot less interest in it than we do has always been farcical.
And Andy, what you really have said, I think, so powerfully is if you don't get this right in terms of what you're dealing with, let alone what your policy objectives are. While it may be our responsibility to get it sorted, you're unlikely to be able to do so. Hey, speaking of the Islamic State, Andy, there's a report on National Public Radio this morning to the effect that one or more Islamic scholars in Saudi Arabia are now taking to the social media platforms to dispute the Islamic teachings and practices of this fellow Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the head of the Islamic State. You've done a lot of serious reading and studying and writing about the teachings of the Quran and the Sunnah and so on. What is your sense of the authority of al-Baghdadi when he lays out an agenda for conquest and all manner of other things?
Well, I get very concerned when stuff like this happens, Frank, because I think that in the West, we tend to see any ideological division among Islamists as a suggestion that that one side or the other is moderating. And in point of fact, what these usually are internal disputes that mean a lot more to the Islamists than they do to us.
In terms particularly of their practical effect, the course of the jihad against us.
Right. You know, no matter how many Saudi jurists of Sharia, they line up to say that, you know, Baghdadi's claims to the caliphate are wrong and he's strategically wrong and he's, you know, ideologically wrong here or there. The bottom line for us, very simply, is they have a lot more in common with each other than they have with us. And that when we get involved, or when we are involved, they put aside their ideological and internecine differences and unite against the common enemy. So, this is the sort of thing that tends to get people in the West to go up in a balloon. You know, Sheikh Karadawi, who is about as radical and incendiary as they come, when he condemned the 9/11 attacks, which he condemned not because he's against terrorism, obviously, but because he thought there would be bad blowback against other Islamists, people in the West went up in a balloon and decided he was a moderate. And at the same time, he was calling for suicide bombing in Israel, and only about 5 minutes later, he was calling for terrorist attacks against American troops in Iraq. So I don't put too much stock in these internal debates among Islamists.
Andy, I'm sorry to say we've run out of time. There's so much more I'm anxious to talk with you about. We'll look forward to doing so again next week. In the meantime, keep up the terrific work you do at National Review and PJ Media, among other outlets. Next up, we'll be speaking with Gordon Chang about the latest developments, Hillary Clinton on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, among other things. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. The Obama administration's efforts to defend the controversial nuclear deal with Iran has become ugly, very ugly. Last week, during a speech at American University, the president portrayed opponents of the deal as partisan Republicans in common cause with Death to America chanting Iranian hardliners. The Tablet, a daily online Jewish magazine, ran an editorial on August 7th claiming that the president is using code anti-Semitic language to criticize Jewish Americans for opposing the Iran deal and to blame them if the deal is rejected by Congress. Some liberal pro-Obama groups have gone further and have questioned the loyalty to this country of Jewish members of Congress who oppose the deal, such as New York Senator Chuck Schumer. The president and his supporters are stooping to smearing opponents of the deal because the agreement is so awful and they cannot defend it on its merits. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Gordon Chang, our duty expert on Asia, is in the house. He is, of course, serving in that capacity for a number of other splendid outlets, notably Forbes.com, where he writes a column. Also, blogs at worldaffairs.com, and of course you see him frequently at Fox News. Gordon, welcome back. It's good to have you with us as always.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, we've been talking for some time, Gordon, about these Chinese man-made islands in the South China Sea that are being used now increasingly, it appears, as platforms for projecting power. I think when last we talked, the Navy, U.S. Navy, was being discouraged by the administration from engaging in what are known as freedom of navigation exercises within the 12-mile sort of keep-out zones that the Chinese are declaring.
That evidently is changing. Talk a little bit about what the latest is on that score.
Both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal came out with stories yesterday about how the freedom of navigation exercises are going to be imminent, that the United States has been consulting with allies in the region about these exercises, how they will be done, how they will not be done, and it appears they'll go through pretty soon. This is in contrast to reporting from Politico at the end of July, that said that the administration was preventing the Navy from going forward. I think the difference is that the administration really wanted to see what Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, had to say when he made his state visit to Washington, and that was last month. Apparently, those discussions did not go terribly well, and that's why there appears to have been a change in heart. We will see what, of course, happens in the next few weeks, and that will be definitive.
And Gordon, is it your expectation that if the Navy does, in fact, steam within these waters, that there will be a challenge by the Chinese that may even come to blows?
There will be a challenge of some sort. When the Navy Reconnaissance P-8 flew close, but not within the 12 nautical miles of these reclamations, then the Chinese attempted to create a no-go zone in the air. They called it a military alert area, and they told the Navy to stay out. There has been reporting in the South China Morning Post of last week that the Chinese are going to go nuclear, literally. There was a report that the 2nd Artillery should maybe fire on the Navy. Now, the 2nd Artillery houses China's strategic nuclear forces. So clearly this was a threat. It was not a direct threat from the People's Liberation Army. It was from, quote, a source close to the PLA. But clearly this was intended to warn the Navy about China's intentions. And if China's going to do something belligerent, we just don't know exactly what.
It presumably will be the case that the ships that the Navy sends through those waters, when it does, will be armed, unlike the P-8. So it may change the calculation a little bit and certainly increases the risks. Gordon, let me turn to we'll be following that closely, as I know will you. Let me turn to another story that you're following closely, and that is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Hillary Clinton is expected this evening to be chastised by some of her Democratic rivals for the presidency over the fact that she is a latecomer to her opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership on 20-plus occasions in the past when she was notably Secretary of State helping with the negotiation of this treaty, that she was very much in favor of it at the time. Is this just a case, as John Kerry famously said, of being for it before he was against it? Or does this augur ill for the future prospects of this agreement?
I think that Hillary Clinton's opposition can't be good for chances of the passage of the agreement. But on the other hand, I think that if she were in a position of influence in the near future, in other words, if she were president, I think she probably would be again for it. This seems to me to be just political opportunism. She's been criticized for this change of view because, as you point out, when she was Secretary of State, she was solidly in favor of this. She called it the gold standard of trade agreements. And so, therefore, there is a sense that Bernie Sanders, another candidate in the Democratic race, is just really pushing her to opposition. So we'll see what she really thinks. But it's at this point, of course, not a good sign for TPP.
You've written about the Chinese alternative to it, the so-called Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, and the efforts of the Chinese, of course, to create their own free trade zone that would essentially exclude the United States as they are being excluded from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You write, however, Gordon, and I keep pressing you on this because I've got deep suspicions as to what may ultimately flow from the TPP if it is in fact approved, namely that it's an open platform and that the Chinese have in the past expressed interest in participating in it. Have you any further reflections on whether they may yet get into it if the deal is in fact done?
Yeah, if the Trans-Pacific Partnership is in fact put in place, as I said, it is an open platform, which means that other countries can join. And clearly there are a list of countries that do want to join. You know, China, if it were able to meet the standards of the agreement, would be one of those countries. But I think that China can't meet those standards because they are very tough, especially in the state enterprise area. But, you know, if China were able to actually comply, I don't think the Communist Party could last. So, yes, there's a real possibility of China joining. No, I don't think as a practical matter they can, because they can't meet the standards. But if they did, well, you know, it might not be a disaster, largely because if they were able to and they actually changed their economy, then I don't think the party could actually survive those types of transformations of China.
Unless, of course, the transformations are not made, the standards are dumbed down instead of them rising to meet them. Again, a subject we'll be following closely. Gordon, let me turn to one other. You've been reporting, of course, on the very, very serious contraction of the Chinese economy. There are new trade numbers. Maybe you could speak to those a little bit. You've also pointed out that, that one Chinese entrepreneur in particular has been hard hit by the losses in the Chinese economy, and that this may have implications for the Nicaraguan canal that he was championing. Give us a flavor of how this is all shaping up.
Wang Jing, who is the entrepreneur behind the canal, lost 84% of his net worth from the middle of June to about a week or so ago. That was because of the slide in the Chinese stock market. Nobody lost a bigger percentage of their wealth in the Bloomberg's Billionaires Index. And the reason why this is important is because construction on the Nicaraguan canal is supposed to start in the next calendar quarter. This is going to be hard because he's got to finance it. At the present time, he hasn't raised the money for the starting of construction. I think that eventually he might be able to do it, but we're going to see a big drama because we're talking about perhaps as much as $50 billion, which is what he estimates. But the Panamanians think it'll be more like $67 to $70 billion in order to complete the canal. This is, I think, one of those dreams that isn't going to happen, largely because the Chinese economy is stumbling.
And just very quickly, Gordon, on the latest numbers, I know there are more that will be coming out shortly, but what's to be drawn from the contracting trade numbers?
Yeah, imports are down a stunning 20.4%. Exports were down 3.7%. They had an enormous surplus of some $60 billion, but the declining import number shows really, I think, that first of all, the manufacturing sector is contracting and that consumption is not as strong as people says it is. We will get third quarter GDP numbers on the 19th, and we'll be getting a lot of other numbers that'll give us a sense of where China is at this moment.
And a sense, perhaps, of what that means, not just for them internally, their economic conditions, but also politically as well, the subject on which you are one of the country's preeminent experts, the author of The Coming Collapse of China, A Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon Chang, Forbes.com. Join us again next week, please. And I hope the rest of you will do so again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.